This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, today on Dreamland, we have a little bit of a new backdrop back there. You'll see if you look beside my shoulder, the Fool card from Greg Bishop's wonderful UFO Tarot deck. Well, basically, every person, researcher, well-known researcher in the UFO world is a card in the deck. I am the Fool, and I think that's a great thing for me to be because I chose the card because when I started, I had no idea what would happen when Communion was published. And so I was definitely a fool walking off the edge of a cliff with no idea what he was doing. And so that's my card in the UFO Tarot. Today, we've got a really fascinating guest. We're going on a deep journey indeed into the world of disclosure and UFO experience and all sorts of things, because we have Jim Lau with us. Jim is has practiced law for 40 years. He was a specialist in municipal and election law, so appellate litigation. So you ask, what's he doing here? Well, somebody came and tapped on his door from the beyond, and that caused him to become interested in us, in UFOs, and to apply his legal skills to the question of disclosure. And we're going to be talking more and a lot about that over the course of the show. Jim, welcome to Dreamland. I'm very pleased that you're here.
Well, thank you. Being a longtime subscriber, I'm happy to be here.
Ah, that I did not, I probably knew, but forgot. Well, good. For once, I'm delighted that another that a subscriber is here. Why did you subscribe, if I may ask?
Well, pretty much I've got every one of your books on the subject. And the key, especially, it speaks directly to me. The master of the key is one of those guiding lights for me, and it has been for a long time.
That's very interesting because, you know, that book, that is really the strangest of all my books. People don't realize it. I've written a few strange books in my life, I will admit. That one is remarkable. And you know, we're recording this during Mercury retrograde, folks. So anything peculiar that happens, like that sound you just heard, just ignore it. Jim's dealing with an ant infestation. All of my usual computer systems are not working correctly. So we're sort of in the usual state. Anyway, that book, that was such an experience. And, you know, reading the book again, going back through it again, I think every single thing he predicted has come true or is coming true. There isn't a single misfire in the whole book. And that's, you know, it's full of predictions. And yet, in 99% of these things you read with these predictions in them are complete nonsense. This isn't. Okay, so let's go on. Jim, you are an attorney. You've practiced law completely outside of the context of UFOs. Yet, here you are. But what does that mean? You're an experiencer, yeah?
Yeah, I'm an experiencer. And it's not something when you practice election law or standing up representing the mayor you talk about, because how it reflected on me was less important than how it reflected on the client. And so I kept that quiet. And until about 2013, when I joined Yvonne Smith's group, Cero, I was pretty much kept it in a closet and hidden from the public. So because in election law, especially, not just municipal law, when the other side doesn't have good arguments, they attack the other side personally. And so it's the kind of thing you cannot represent, you know, a public entity about, or any citizens group that may not fall into the category that we fall into. And so I kept it to myself. And in 2013, I started reaching out, joined Yvonne's group, and have been going to conferences ever since, mostly not to listen to the speakers, but to meet with other experiencers, just to see where I was compared to them. And I've pretty much learned that I'm just an average experiencer. Nothing special about my experiences. The experiences are extraordinary, but it's not, I'm no different than you or anyone else that has these experiences.
It's well said. Where we are is we live in the ordinary extraordinary.
Yes.
Or the extraordinary ordinary. Take your pick.
That's the way of putting it.
That's where we are. And it's an extraordinary place to be and a very serious place to be at the same time. So you came, tell us, you know, Jim, I think we need to start with your experience. Why don't you tell us what exactly happened to you? But before we do that, free Dreamlanders, listen up. We're back. We're talking to Jim Lau, his new book, the UFO Briefing Book. You can reach him at jplufo.com. Jim, before we paused for our free Dreamlanders and directed them to buy perhaps a copy of them or Communion or even my new book of poems, I don't know what ads ran, but certainly also to subscribe to this wonderful website. We were getting ready to go into what happened to you. Why did you come into this world? Because you sure weren't in it when you were a kid or even a young man. When did it happen and what happened?
Well, actually, I've been a lifelong experiencer. My first conscious memory was when I was 5 and a half. We were camping and building a cabin, my family and my uncle's family. And we're sitting out by the campfire. And all of a sudden, over the cow pasture next to our property, a large round object appeared and came very close, about 500 feet away from us, and started. The best way to describe it is to listen to Colonel Charles Halt's description of what the Rendlesham Forest object that he saw was. And it was round. It sort of like blinked. It had what looked like dripping metal falling off of it onto a dry field. It was the week before I started kindergarten, Saturday night before I started kindergarten. And I remember looking up at my relatives, and they looked like characters in a Steven Spielberg movie. They were just transfixed and frozen. And that's the last thing I remember. And then the next morning, I go out and around the campfire, all the adults are drinking coffee and talking about the comet they saw. And so to a 5 and a half-year-old, I assumed the comets just came down like that. And even when I learned differently in high school science, that's not what comets do, I still kept that in my head, that's what had happened. But I remember driving home Sunday night, talking to my dad about it. And the next morning was my first day of kindergarten, and I got up and the first thing I said to my dad when I saw him was, you know, wasn't that comet neat? And that was the term back then, neat. And he looked at me like I was crazy and said, I don't know what you're talking about. And he had forgotten it from that point on. And I have a firm memory of it, and it hasn't changed since. And so I had experiences when I was in high school that I remember, and all the way up through adulthood. And it's more remotely or telepathically now, but I've had many experiences, some of which I've regressed with Yvonne Smith, although I'm a terrible regression patient.
Well, me too. I was regressed 3 times successfully. Is that beeping coming from your end?
Yes, and I can't figure out how to stop it.
Okay, well, that's because Mercury's retrograde. As soon as Mercury isn't retrograde anymore, 2 things will happen. One is you'll figure out how to stop it, and 2 is it won't happen anymore anyway. So that's where we are now, and that's okay.
I apologize. I'm just back from vacation, which is why I'm still I'm still wearing my Grizzly Adams beard and wearing a baseball cap. So sorry.
Well, I want to just mention in passing that there's a video on YouTube, which I'll show a clip of as we're talking, of the very thing that you mentioned. It takes place over a firebase in Afghanistan, and you can see 2 UFOs with that strange metallic substance falling right out of the bases of them, which is also the same thing that was seen at the Maury Island UFO incident. And it's interesting. It's some kind of technological effect. But what? Just a minute. I mean, but what? We just don't know, do we? We have no idea. So anyway, let's move on from your childhood experience, your first experience. And you were getting ready to tell us about things that happened in high school and a little later. Did anything else happen in your late childhood? And if not, when did it start again?
Pretty much, you know, high school and then through college, it was sort of sporadic. The question is, I don't know when it started and when it ended, because I, like most experiencers, I don't remember everything.
I think we remember so little.
Yeah, I'm talking to other people that are experiencers. That seems to be the case, is that people don't aren't able to recall everything. Sometimes my thinking is it must be a glitch in the way they do things that we do learn, or maybe it's deliberate. In some cases, I believe it's deliberate. And in John Mack's book, he had one of his books, he talked about one experiencer who was asked them, why don't you show yourselves? And the being spoke and said, you know, we want you to believe in us, but not too much. And I think that sort of encapsulates it.
Well, you know, I think that's an incredibly interesting answer, because I know pretty much what I think, or I think I know what it means. If they were to walk down the streets, our whole world would immediately turn toward them, what they have, what we can get from them. Everything else would stop. We wouldn't care anymore when we can suddenly realize that these people who are able to do things like moving UFOs and so forth disappear and reappear at will and have so much fantastic control over their world. And if it is even technology so far beyond what we can understand, it's just unbelievable. So we would totally turn toward that. That's called cultural colonization in anthropology. And it's what happens when, like in New Guinea, in World War II, when the Air Force began landing planes on the island, these people had never seen anything like that before. and started bringing out all kinds of beer and food and stuff from the plains, they wanted to do it too. And they forgot about their own culture and started making bamboo planes and trying to get beer. That's what we're doing now behind the scenes. That's why there are no human-made UFOs floating around, because we can't figure it out. We're basically building bamboo UFOs at great expense behind the scenes.
Well, Hollywood is a cargo cult, I guess, in that regard.
Well, I mean, the Defense Department's a cargo cult. I'm sorry, it's much worse than Hollywood, because they are spending a fortune on it. Like the Aurora space plane, which they now claim never existed, was they spent maybe as billions and billions of dollars on it. I have a friend who saw it in its test bed, and another friend who has who was a flight surgeon who was treating the pilots of this thing for busted hips because it had a G counter system in it, where when the plane made a super tight turn, this thing would bang up against their hip to equalize the G forces.
Ooh.
And they were getting broken hips. You know, it was there. It was real. There's an electrostatic or a magnetic device in it that enables it to do the sort of falling leaf effect that we see sometimes in UFOs. But it's not anti-gravity. It's a jet. And, you know, there's probably some ideation of it out there that we don't get told about. But it's still cargo cult stuff. You're not going to emulate the functioning of a UFO unless you have that propulsion system, and we do not.
And we've been trying since at least 1947.
At least since 1947. And we need to face the fact that they can't do it. We can't do it. And we've got to do something else. Let's keep on with your story, because it's not over yet. We'll get to the UFO briefing book in big time shortly. But right now, are there any experiences that really stand out in your mind beyond the 5-year-old one?
When I was 17, I was playing basketball. It was April of 1970, I think it was. I was a junior in high school. And I was walking home from playing a couple hours of basketball. And instead of going home, I made a right turn and went to a park and decided to lay down, which was sort of stupid, because the park was still growing grass. And so I laid down as sweaty gym clothes on, laid down in the ground that had mulch on top of it. And the air, as soon as I lay down, the area just got dead silent, completely silent. And so I looked up. I was living in San Dimas, California, which is east of Los Angeles. And I looked up and I saw not an object. I saw sort of a hole in the sky, it looked like to me, because it was a starlit night, no moon, but I could see pretty well. And this lenticular shape object, or something that was blacker than the sky, was moving towards Los Angeles. And it was near an airport, Brackett Field. And so I was thinking, wow, what a weird time. Brackett Field's closed at night. They didn't have night landings. And then I couldn't see it. And I'm going, wait a minute, I can't hear it either. And so I thought to myself, okay, it's not a helicopter. It's not a plane. And then I started thinking to myself, it's a UFO. And before I even finished the thought in my head, the object did a 130-degree straight edge turn towards me and started heading down. It was probably 3,000 to 5,000 feet up in the sky and started heading down in a straight line right towards me. And so I stood up so I could get a better view of it. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And I reached down and grabbed a rock. And without looking, I just reached around the ground, found a rock. And when it got close enough, it looked like it was maybe 50 to 75 feet above my head. I threw the rock directly up in the air at it, and it missed. It didn't hit it, but the rock came down and nearly hit my head, coming right back down towards me, and I never moved. And so when it got to me, it appeared to just keep going and going into the mountains, the San Gabriel Mountains behind me, and it disappeared. And so just like that. And so 50, 60 years later, whatever, I am regressed by Yvonne Smith about the incident. And I don't really see much. But after she did the regression, I was going to drive back to the San Diego area where I live. I decided to drive through San Dimas and stop at that point. And I stood at the spot, and I remember the UFO passed over. It was about 30, if it was 75 feet in the air, it was 30 feet around, typical lenticular-shaped, round, flying saucer shape. But it was just, but there were, I couldn't see this. It was like the absence of light. So I'm standing at this spot, and I remember clearly watching it go over a water tower. And I looked around behind me, and there was no water tower. And then I looked over to my right and saw the water tower. And then I realized, wait a minute. 1 millisecond, I'm facing one way. The next millisecond, I'm turned another way. And so instead of going straight behind me, it went like this, and then a right angle over to the northwest. And so I realized at that moment, it just hit me just like that, that I had experienced missing time where they put me back facing a different direction than I was. And it was a subtle difference, but it took me 50 years to make that connection. And so I don't know what happened, because Yvonne couldn't break past that point. She always teases me that I'm a lawyer and I have trouble following direction. Probably she's correct in that regard.
Well, this is an absolutely classic example of missing time. You know, I was once had missing time demonstrated to me. It was years ago in Paris. I was had fallen ill, and my family, we were in an apartment. This is long before Airbnb in Montparnasse, and I was not able to go touring that day, so I had to stay in the flat. My family left. And a few minutes after they left, there came a knock on the door. It was two men, and they were very polite. They said they were French intelligence officers, and they said they would like to interview me when I was in the state that I thought of as missing time. And I said, well, how can you do that? And they said, well, we can induce it. It's induced with sound. And I said, well, I'd like a copy of the interview then. He said, the man said, no, I can't do that, but I can let you listen to it. But I want to warn you beforehand, to be honest, you will not remember it for long. And they had come in, and we were standing now in the apartment foyer. And I said, well, I thought to myself, I'm not going to pass this up. At least I'll be able to listen to it. And I figured I'll remember it all right. So I said, I'm game. Let's do it. And he said, would you like to listen to it? I said, yeah. And he said, okay. And he started with this little tape recorder he had, rewinding it. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, we did the interview. There was no gap at all. At all.
Like it.
And listen, do you know what this means? It means that this could happen anytime. We don't know who we are and where we are. We don't know. Anyway, long story short, I did listen to it. I figured I would remember it. Now what I remember is only this, and I've remembered this ever since it happened. It made me extremely happy. I felt wonderful. And I don't know why. Early the next morning at 5 a.m., when my family came back from the day, I told them a whole story, of course. My daughter-in-law had to go to the airport very early, and I went downstairs with her to help her get a cab. I obviously wasn't going to let her go out on the streets of Paris at 5 o'clock in the morning to get a cab by herself. And there were the two guys sitting there in a little Mercedes on the roadside, on the street, and they laughed. And they were laughing, and I waved at her and I said, Julie, come over. Let's talk to them. And they just drove off.
Oh, my. I don't
know who they were, French intelligence or not. No idea. Isn't that a great story, though?
Amazing. Amazing. Well, that fits with what, you know, happened to me. And I'd like to tell two different stories that if I could. One relates to you. And one was when I was in Paris one time. The one that relates to you is I was doing one of my three regressions with Von Smith. And we were doing it on a particular instance in my life. When I was 48 years old, I was covering a council meeting in a small town called Sanger, California, outside of Fresno, where I lived. And I got home about 11:30. It was a late meeting, a very contentious meeting. And so I went in our walk-in closet and changed so I wouldn't wake up my wife, went to bed. And the next thing I remember is I wake up and say out loud to myself, so that's what they look like. And I was standing on the sidewalk out front of my house in my underwear. It was cold. It was in October of 98. And I looked at the front door and realized, you know, I can't just stand here in the cold. I've got to go in. And I was hoping, oh, I hope the door opens. And so I was in light that was brighter than sunlight. Yet I didn't look up. And I just walked towards the door. And I'm thinking to myself, I've got to remember everything about this. And I open the door, go in the house, get in bed. The next morning, I didn't have to go to work. And so I slept in. About 8 o'clock, I woke up and the entire world was spinning. And it wasn't spinning like this. It was like the entire world would shift to one side to the other, then go back again. That's a particular kind of vertigo. And I was like that for 2 weeks. I couldn't drive.
Oh my goodness.
I couldn't drive. And when I finally could focus, you know, I went into the doctor's office and the doctor just gave me some anti-nausea medication and sent me home. And so for 2 weeks, I was like that. When I woke up, when I finally could focus, here, I'll take off when I finally could focus, let's see, it's this side. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got to, you know, if I knew how it went left from right, I wouldn't have been a lawyer. I would have
lean in and maybe see it a little bit.
Yeah, here we go. Okay. You see there's I've got a scar coming down right here. You see it right there. And I had two scars.
Okay.
See,
yeah, that's fine, Jim. We probably won't be able to see it, but
okay. Well, I had two scars there, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong. So fast forward after the regression, I'm trying to figure out what I learned about it. During the regression, my eyelids were shut, but I was able to see through a little slit in my eyes, and I saw the top half of an alien, classic gray, big eyes, that kind of thing. And so the alien stepped back from me a little bit, and then I saw this with my eyes shut. I saw this motion going this way, like sort of over my eyes and my forehead. And then something was happening. I could feel something happening. And then about 45 seconds to 90 seconds later, it went the same kind of motion, looking like sort of a boomerang, went the other way again. And so I couldn't figure out what that was. And Yvonne, it was unusual for Yvonne too. And so when I come home from the regression, I was going to read a book. You know, I always read to go to sleep. And I didn't have I just finished a book by half the time. And so I didn't have a book. So I went to my bookshelf. And what I do is I look for, when I don't have any reading material, I look for bookmarks to see where I stopped in a book. And I picked up Communion Letters and looked at a bookmark, and the bookmark said November 1997, because it was the receipt from the bookstore when I bought your book. And so I started reading from that point. And I read about three pages of one chapter and then went to sleep when I got to the end of that chapter. And the next morning I got up, it was Monday morning, and I started reading the next chapter over breakfast. And it was about a person that had written to you and mentioned that they were abducted, they were taken aboard, and a boomerang type object was waved in front of them. And they split their skull open at the exact same point as mine, as where these marks are. And
I'm
so at that point, in the letter, the gentleman said that they put some sort of like ruby type, you know, plastic, you know, glass or whatever objects inside his head. And then the boomerang type object was waved over him the opposite way, and it closed up his wound. And I'm going, that's exactly what happened with mine. And I would have known about it ahead of time, about this thing, if I'd have finished your book. Instead of just, you know, I just set it in the shelf thinking I'd finished it, because it was not, you know, they were just different letters. Everyone was different. So
the experience you had happened after you stopped reading the book?
Yeah. The next year. Okay. I bought the book in November.
You read at that point, then you have the experience. Then you take the book down and start reading again, and there's the other person's experience.
40 years later, yes. The 30 years later.
30 years later.
I was triggered by what I saw, the bits. I just saw bits and pieces in the regression.
So you were triggered by the regression. And this is like something, some presence or force is helping you put this memory together, weaving it together and using the book as a tool.
And that tells me they can go backwards and forwards in time, because I stopped reading the book almost a year before I had the incident, and then didn't discover it till probably 2016 or so.
Now, listen, free listeners, I have been so riveted by this, and I'm sure you have been too. I forgot the second break, so I'm going to tell you what might have been in it. What might have been in it is a beautiful commercial called Stars, which is, it reminds you of the wonder of unknowncountry.com and the joy of exploring it, which is a huge, extraordinary website filled with stuff like this. I mean, there's no place like it in the world. And then there probably was a commercial for them. And if you haven't read them yet, now is the time, because what the kind of things Jim is talking about are exactly the kind of things that are analyzed in them. Okay, Jim, now that done, the commercial that isn't a commercial, let's continue on. I think we're getting to the point where we might start talking about your book, the UFO Briefing Book. And let's go ahead and start talking about that. And but if you want to weave in, unless there are experiences that you haven't touched on that you would like to talk about. The book's very comprehensive, and it's called the UFO Briefing Book for a very specific reason. And it's basically the work of an attorney. Now, we're shifting gears here. This is an experiencer. He's also a lawyer, and he is now using his legal skills in order to further the interests of us experiencers and every single human being on planet Earth. So, Jim, first, give us an idea of what made you decide to do this. Why did you decide to write the UFO Briefing Book?
Marco Rubio, in July of 2020, issued a request to the UAP Task Force of the Navy for a report on UAPs. And once he did that, I immediately dropped everything I was doing and decided to write what I thought was going to be a long paper on what Congress will get from the Pentagon and what they need to do about it. And so I was going to just write a paper, but once I started pricing out how much it would cost me to send 200 book or papers to Congress, I looked into self-publishing a book, and that was actually cheaper. So I self-published the UFO Briefing Book, A Congressional Guide to the UAP Phenomena. And a friend of mine, who's a retired city manager, he was one of my first people that read it, said it reads like a 128-page staff report. Because what I did is I went through a little bit of the history of UFOs as it relates to the government and Congress, not just general history about the subject, and then explained to the members of Congress that I sent it to that the Pentagon will slow walk everything to you. They will not give you anything without, you know, having it pulled literally from them by surgery. And that here's what you're going to need to do. And so I made some recommendations. One is you need to strengthen whistleblower protections. Another is you need to change FOIA to allow for, you know, the presumption that UAP information should automatically become public unless there's a demonstrated clear and convincing evidence of a security reason to keep it quiet. And then I went through a couple of other things, pretty much all of which have ended up in legislation. I finished the book in March of 2021 and got it to members of Congress in March and April. And it laid out the history of how Congress has been kept out of this subject, relying very heavily on David Jacobs' wonderful book, UFO Controversy in America, written in 1973 or 4, which was
That's a brilliant book, by the way, but go ahead.
It is. And so I walk through what they need to do, and I sent it off. Like I said, I sent out 300 copies of it. At least 200 of them went to Congress. And I also sent a few to private people, one of which I sent it to Harry Reid. I was thinking, I'll never be able to find Harry Reid's retirement address. And so I went on Google Maps, and it just popped up just like that.
Wow.
And so I got his home address off of Google. You know, and so I sent it to retired Senator Reid, and he's the only one that got back to me. And he wrote me a personal note saying, this is 3 months before he passed, saying that, you know, the book was well done, done well. He used old English. It was done well. And he thanked me for my interest in the vital subject. And so, but the congressmen and senators I sent it to, I didn't hear from any of them.
Yeah, that happened to me when I sent out them to the congressmen and senators. You know, they talk the talk, but I have a feeling these guys ain't walking the walk. So, free Dreamlanders, we have reached the end of our time together. And I would like to say, I would, as always, thank you very much for being with us. To remind you, Jim Lau's website is jplufo.com. His new book is the UFO Briefing Book. And why don't you get a copy? Send it to your congressman and tell them, and senators, and tell them, get on the stick. Don't ignore this. Don't let it pass, and don't let the Defense Department drag its heels, which it is doing, dragging its heels. Okay, thank you anyway, Free Dreamlanders, for being with us. We'll see you again next week. Oh, yeah. Okay, this is the historical comparison of the Nimitz, Roosevelt, and Coast Guard sightings. And you mentioned Congress received its first briefing on this subject in 1964, July of 1964, within several months after this publication, in 1965-67, wave of UFO sightings began in the United States. These increased incidents led to the first and only congressional hearing about UFOs in July of 1968. Now, I have noticed a massive increase in UFO sightings in the past few years.
Yes.
Could it be that this effort to get the story out and get the Congress to drag it out of the coffers of the Defense Department is being supported by the visitors themselves in this way?
It's hard to say. I think so. I've had so many synchronicities that have led me to this point that I can't help but think that at least some of them are trying to get us to move our governments to get this disclosed. One of my things that I've always looked back on is your conversation with the Master of the Key. And there was you talked about, you know, we need to fight. Yeah, I'm paraphrasing. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm paraphrasing the Master of the Key, which is dangerous in and of itself. But they want us to not fight behind the scenes secretly, but bring it out in the open and fight for our place. And I think that's part of the deal, is I think that we're being asked as experiencers, and many of us around the world are doing a lot of things like I'm doing, that we are forcing the issue, and the governments need to openly oppose any sort of negativity from beyond and stand up for ourselves. And I don't think we've been doing that. We've been hiding it. We've got the Pentagon's hiding the fact that they can't stop them from taking us.
You know, a new world, if you can take it.
Yes.
Sums it all up. That's from, of course, from Phil Corso. Corso's Close Encounter Experience. And yeah, and we're not doing that. We are not, because the Defense Department keeps us helpless. And let me ask you this. Have you got the sense, and I have to admit I do, I'm not going to be coy about it, that the Defense Department is ended up working for, in some way, someone who does not have the best interests of mankind at heart?
I agree.
Something's
wrong. 100%.
Yeah. Give us some reasons why you feel this as well, and we can sort of have a discussion about it.
My thinking is that either through embarrassment, that they don't want to admit that they had, you know, interactions with non-terrestrial intelligence, or NHI, as some people say. I also think it might be that they're just covering themselves up. But my thinking is they're basically doing their bidding by keeping it quiet.
I think that's exactly right. Because, you know, if everyone knew this was real and abductions could happen, things would be quite a bit different after dark in this world than they are now. I mean, I know, I had no idea, you had no idea, none of us did, that this could even happen. And yet, then there it was. And, you know, in 1993, Dr. Michael Persinger published a paper which had been, I believe, had been commissioned by the Defense Department about UFO abductions stories, in which he points out that he went to 100 and something people and who had claimed abduction experiences, and that they had all had trauma in their childhoods, which I had, and in his book, in the in his paper, he concludes that what abductions are confabulated childhood trauma experiences. And this, as I understand it, is being worked on right now as a fallback position in the Pentagon that they will turn to if it becomes impossible to deny the abductions any further. That their plan is to say to the NPRs and New York Timeses of the world, nothing to worry about. These are just people who had childhood experiences, and this paper proves that this is just nonsense. So expect that.
They're trying to get, to me, they're setting up lines of defenses, and sort of like when the Maginot Line fails, they move back to another one, you know, and they're just, they're running out of ideas.
Yeah.
And it's just not going to happen. I think Lou's book that just came out, Imminent.
Imminent, yeah. I've just read it this morning, actually.
I read through his preface, and I'm up to chapter 3 now, but I had to put it down. I just started crying.
Why is that?
Because someone is saying, besides us experiencers, what's going on. And it just opened, you know, we're talking about a person who worked directly with Congress, has some credibility with them. And his book is finally addressing the issues. And a tagline from him in his interview with CBS Morning is, America can handle the truth.
Well,
and they've been Jack Nicholson saying, we can't handle the truth.
Well, that's a real good question as to whether or not we can. Because the truth is, the abductions happened. They still happen from time to time. And they do involve, among many other things, the taking of sexual material from people's bodies, just as Dave Jacobs claimed, and just as I personally experienced. And many, many others did too. So, you know, can we handle that?
Well, I've been working on, and I'm about ready to publish, a sort of step-by-step process how Congress, in working on a bipartisan basis with, you know, the presidential administration, if they can all work on a bipartisan basis, sort of giving them a blueprint of how they should release things one at a time and through public hearing processes that aren't the typical congressional, one side shoots arrows, the other side shoots them back. And I'm just a former city attorney who has worked on legislation for 40 years, but why am I doing this? I look back over the last 20 years and I look at synchronicity after synchronicity has happened to me. And I really haven't talked about this at all, but there are incidents in my life that I think have led to my participation. And I'm working currently with a group of attorneys from around the country trying to put together, you know, ideas for Congress on how they do things. For instance, in 2004, I had an associate that worked for me whose husband was the judge advocate, the chief legal officer in the Nimitz. So she got a tour for us, and we didn't have the regular tour guide. We had her husband give us a tour, and I brought my son along with us. And so this was on, I may get the dates a little wrong. This is on November 10th, 2004. We took a tour of the Nimitz. We get up, the highlight of the tour was we were in the Combat Information Center. I think that's what it was called at the time. And our tour guide asked one of the enlisted men in front of radar screens, what are you doing? And I remember this very distinctly. He said, we're calibrating the new software upgrades. And then the officer of the deck, who was the executive officer of the crew of the ship, turned to the chief legal officer and said, don't you ever ask a question like that in front of civilians again, which is why it stuck in my head. 2 days later, on the 12th, the Nimitz sailed out of San Diego Bay, and Lieutenant Commander Fravor and Lieutenant Dietrich saw the first tic tac, but also the USS Princeton, which was the main radar and sensor platform for the task force. Kevin Day was in charge as the chief petty officer of that, saw 50 or 60 UFOs all slowly transiting across. And so that was 2 days after I learned this. Fast forward 10 years, I'm manning Yvonne Smith's book table at the end of a conference on the Sunday afternoon. Sitting across from me is a guy named Kevin Day. I didn't know who he was. There was no one in the exhibit hall. So we ended up just chatting. And he talked about the Nimitz incident. I didn't mention that I had been on the Nimitz. But he said to me, my belief, Kevin said, my belief is that the radar upgrades, software upgrades we did, allowed us to see them. And so I heard that over 10 years from two different points.
And, so,
you, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, let's go ahead. But you know, incidentally, folks, Kevin Day was interviewed on Dreamland in February of 2022. So, and it's a wonderful interview. So if you want to get into Kevin's story, that's the place to go, because there's no other Close Encounter witness has a show where he can interview people who have had these experiences. And you will find that Kevin had a much more complex experience personally than it would seem on the surface. So,
and Kevin then also in interviews, probably in that one too, mentioned that radar, all the tapes were removed by Air Force officers. And he said this 10 years ago. And so what does Sean Kirkpatrick come out and say? He comes out and says that the Nimitz tapes are destroyed right after the incident, routinely, which is false, demonstrably false.
Of course,
you know, multiple witnesses know that's not true.
What happened when Congressman Stephen Schiff back in the 90s tried to get the Roswell stuff. He said to me what I said. He said after he was elected, he says to me, I was elected in part to get to the bottom of the Roswell incident. I want you to tell me how to do it. And I said, you've got to get the records of all of the records from the base, from the whole period when this was happening, which started in 1946 and didn't end until 1952. A lot of that stuff is just not present in the public space at all. So he gets what is then called the General Accounting Office to do this, and they proceed to be told all of the records have been destroyed illegally.
Yes.
And that's characteristic of this. This thing is so intimidating to the Defense Department that they are willing to openly violate the law in order to protect their secrets. Why do you think that is, Jim?
I still think it's because they can't account for the fact that they've let the abduction phenomena go on. They know it's occurring, and yet they'd rather hide it. And maybe worse, maybe they're in collusion, like we talked about earlier, maybe they're in collusion with them. But I think the abduction phenomena is key to opening the door. We've got senators on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that have had their ontological shock moment discovering that they're real.
Yeah.
And now the next ontological shock moment will be us.
I hope. And it will be an ontological shock moment. But, you know, they have definitely known about this a long time. And I can tell you why I know that. David W. Webb was a leading space sciences researcher and a consultant to every alphabet agency there was and is. And where does he end up in 1986? He gets in touch with me. This is before Communion was published, you understand, and ends up coming out to the cabin to see what he can see. He introduces me to an allergist who then gives me epinephrine injectors and allergy shots that reduce my allergic response to the visitors, which was considerable. In other words, he knew this, all of this. He was the sweetest man in the world. Both of us loved him. And he would come out to the cabin, came out one or two times, and he had dinner with us in New York. And he was just a lovely man and very knowledgeable and very, very highly, deeply connected. So they know. They have to. They couldn't. They sent one of their top guys to visit with us. So, yeah, they know.
Well, talking to one of the people I know that made the rounds of Washington recently, one of the things that they discovered was there's, as the person told me, there's a base in San Gabriel. And I'm going, no, you mean the San Gabriel Mountains. And so I have a small chat group of people from that are CERO members. And I told them that. And they all, with the LOLs and all the laughs you get over, you know, messages, they go, you mean the government's just finding that out?
When you say in San Gabriel, exactly what do you mean and where is it?
In the San Gabriel Mountains behind Monrovia, along that, I've lived from Altadena to San Dimas, which is both, and the ships would go back at a different angle from each place. And I know 10, 12 people that live in that area that are experiencers that have had the same, you know, type of incident. One is Adrian Rudnick, who had worked for JPL at one point, has a very good book, Intersect, about this. And it's back there. There's there. And I've always had a fear of Malibu. Always. And the one time I actually went to Malibu was for a meditation thing that you had done in a house there.
Yeah, at Lee McCloskey's house.
Yeah, that's right. And it just I shook for days after being there.
Well, you know,
I know a lot about
these bases, and I'm not uncomfortable with this at all. I've never lived in my life in an area that was not near them in one way or another. And so they're very intimidating, and they're intimidating because the body is just a covering as far as they're concerned. Right. They go straight for the soul. And, you know, one of the things that worries me about the secrecy is that there are certain members of this bizarre community that I call the visitors who love to get into control of souls that are too heavy to ascend. And when you keep a lot of secrets and you do a lot of things that are wrong and hurtful to others, when you die, you're trapped. And I think that many of these people in the intelligence community and in the Air Force especially are getting snared in that trap. And that could be one of the other reasons for the secrecy, is to capture souls and to do it that way, to make them, to load them up with so much what we call karma that they can't escape. And that scares me, because I know a lot of these guys, and I know they're very religious, especially the Air Force ones. And I think to myself, it ain't going to help, fellas. You've got to live a good life. And that means a humble, honest life where you give everything you can. That's the life of the person who will ascend. And living this kind of life where you live in your arrogance and your lies, and you keep things from people that hurt them because you're keeping them from them, that does not fly. You literally don't fly.
I couldn't agree more. I wonder the connection, if there's any connection between that and the fact the ships, I think they're alive. I think the ships are alive. Many times I've felt like that one incident I talked about where it switched to me, my thought, it immediately switched and came, like I was scheduled at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they go, well, let's take them now, you know? And I always have the feeling when the few times I've seen craft close, that when I'm thinking thoughts, the ship itself knows that. And one of the problems, they're never going to be able to develop, you know, this kind of technology without, I think it's a lot of it's soul based. And so maybe there's a connection. I don't know.
Oh, I think you're right. I think it is soul based. I think there's huge amounts of technology that are in the non-physical. I think I wear a piece of it in my ear. In my opinion, I mean, they even told me, two men, not aliens, two men told me that this was designed by a man named Konstantin Rodovay. It was put in by two people, and there were people in the yard and in the driveway at the time this happened in 1989. It was an all-people operation, but it had something to do also with the world of the dead. And this now is my go-to. Absolutely. I had this wonderful, brilliant young woman who was a muse to me in England, and she was really helpful working on my books, but then she decided I was too sweet on her and blew me off because there's a bit of an age gap. Which, you know, it was her decision. I wasn't all that sweet on her, frankly, but I didn't want to make her feel bad by saying that. So I said, yeah, well, maybe we should. Anyway, I lost her, and I lost this unbelievable genius. But the implant came to my rescue, and now I'm working on a new book, and I have absolutely never had this thing work like it works now. It's just, and what it does is, among other things, synchronicities. You know, when I need something, a synchronicity occurs, and there it is. And that's the way we live, all of us. I think you do too.
Oh, absolutely. I live from synchronicity to synchronicity.
Absolutely. You know,
working on this stuff, I mean, well, if I didn't have an ataxia, I'd be playing golf. You know, I wouldn't be doing, you know, doing something else.
You were activated. You were literally activated. And so was I. I mean, I was living a life that had nothing whatsoever to do with any of this. And then, bang, I got turned upside down and inside out, and I'm living another life now, and this is my life. And you're the same way. You're the same way. They chose you because they knew when you were a little 5-year-old baby that you were going to be out there doing this. And you know, I think they live outside of time, and I think that's also a problem of theirs, because nothing is ever new to them. And I think it must be kind of awful to be like that.
Yeah.
And everything is new to us. So that's why they want communion with us. They want to share our sense of the new and the excitement of life. I know this. I just know this.
And the hybrids are the best of both worlds. Maybe. Well, that's what they're trying to do.
I've met a lot of hybrids, and I've met some of them. Well, look, there's a group of hybrids that, in my opinion, protect me. I hated them for a long time. I was terrified of them until I realized that, you know, all when they do not pat you on the shoulder, but they do warn you, and they are there for you. They're just not very pleasant.
I could do a whole show on that. You know,
Jim, we've got to get this going. We got to do that show. Okay, so here's your assignment from Whitley Strieber and Dreamland. Think about hybrids and think about doing a whole show on hybrids. And let's maybe talk. I know other experiencers, and maybe hybrids. Would you come on?
Absolutely.
You know, when someone says to me, I'm a hybrid, they can't lie to me. And they, in other words, if they just are dreaming that up or they're telling a lie, I'm going to know immediately, because I've been with real hybrids enough to know what it's like, what they are like, and how they manifest and how it feels to be with them. So maybe we could find a real hybrid to come on. So far.
Yeah, I certainly am not, but yeah, that's the kind of thing that I always use the analogy of an onion, and we're on layer 3 out of 100.
Yeah. Well, I know, sir, I'm not near here, but I do know a place where I think some hybrids live in Las Vegas, and maybe I'll just go up there and knock on their door and see what happens.
They'll know you're coming.
Yeah, well, that is very true. They definitely have that ability in spades. That is one of the most remarkable things about them. Jim Lau, it has been such a wonderful experience to have you on Dreamland. Really, really good. Get Jim's UFO briefing book from the unknowncountry.com store and send a copy to your representatives. They might listen to you. They're not going to listen to Jim because he's not in their district, but you are in their district. You, in fact, every experiencer in the country who hears this, you need to get on the stick and get this book and get it to your congressman in your district and say, hey, I care about this. I care. That'll get some action.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me on. I apologize for my aunt crisis. And I haven't shaved in 4 weeks. And I was going to shave before the show and actually comb my hair. But, but yeah, I apologize.
Well, you know, when you say comb your hair, you've had your hat off, and I'm sure my listeners and viewers are also wondering what that would mean.
This side and this side.
Okay, the sides. Then we understand.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a great show, Jim. And, you know, I love talking to other experiencers because we're so much on the same wavelength, and half the show is sort of going on in our heads. And, you know, we're not telepathic exactly, but we're very close to each other in here when we're communicating. It's been a joy. Thank you.
I'm here. You take care of yourself.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.